Cleo, Erato, Polyhymnia. Among the nine muses of Greek mythology, there's no muse for the essay. And that's not only because the essay doesn't appear in name until Montaigne publishes his first book of them in 1850. No, one gets the feeling that, even if Homer had composed essays about the wine dark sea or rosy-fingered dawn, this literary genre, so often associated with five-paragraph structures in freshman composition courses, still wouldn't have a goddess representing it on Mount Parnassus. The essay, unlike the epic or the love poem, is just too pedestrian, too workaday and uninspired to find a place among the timeless arts. That doesn't stop Ned Stuckey French from championing the essay. In fact, for Stuckey French, the middling nature of the essay is one of its very virtues. In his study, The American Essay in the American Century, he gives us a vision of the essay as a genre that's as plucky and adaptable as the American spirit itself, showing us how writers and readers reinvented it at the beginning of the 20th century for a new nation, one teeming with Ford motor cars and weekly magazines and a growing middle class, eager for writing that spoke to its fears and desires. Stuckey French shows us how and why the essay, that creation of a Renaissance French aristocrat, becomes an American essay, a democratic genre, able to take the pulse of our bustling nation. And if this social history of the essay weren't enough, Stuckey French has also published with his co-editor Carl Krauss an anthology of essayists on the essay, a collection of writing that begins with Montaigne and takes us right up to the present, where the essay is once again adapting to a new world, one of web browsers and blogs, smartphones and video. And yet the essay lives on, undaunted, ready to take up the challenges of our new century.
Stuckey French, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much, Eric. Thanks for asking me.
It's great to have you here. And you've got not one, but two really fascinating books that are centering around the essay. There's the essay, Essayists on the Essay, and the American Essay in the American Century. And I'm looking forward to diving into both of them. But first, I'm kind of curious, what brings you to the essay? You know, it's as you yourself write, a kind of underwritten about, under-theorized genre, and suddenly we have not one but two books from you.
Well, it's a long story with many baby steps, I suppose, but I was out of academics for a long time, or out of the academy for a long time. I worked as a union organizer for 10 years, a high school teacher for 4 years and so forth. But I kept reading all that time and I always read fiction. I'd read lots, I was always reading, always had a novel going, but I also found that I was really drawn to a lot of the contemporary American essayists who, I guess one could argue or say, or some have said, are creating a kind of a renaissance for the form in America. People like, Joan Didion, Edward Hoagland, Barry Lopez, Scott Russell Sanders, Annie Dillard. I was reading them anyway. I was interested in nature writing especially. So when I met my wife, Elizabeth, who's a novelist, and we decided to go back to graduate school, this was about 1990, we were looking for programs where we might both be happy, and Iowa was that place. I went there for a PhD in literature, and she went to be in the writer's workshop. And at that point, a lot of my interest was in nature writing. And so, I took a class on Thoreau, this and that. But increasingly, I realized I was really, it was bigger than that. It was not just nature writing, but it was the personal essay was what was intriguing me the most. And I had fallen into perhaps the best place to find that was an interest of mine, because Carl Klaus was there. I had gone to graduate school originally back in the 70s at Brown, and had worked with Robert Scholes. And now I found myself working with Carl Klaus, who is Bob Scholes' best friend. They had collaborated on books back in the 70s and 80s. And Carl was organizing a reading group of graduate students, I think there were six of us, to begin to try to look at what essayists themselves were saying about the essay. Because as you suggested, the genre is a seen as kind of a service genre. It's a genre used to write about other more literary, more fancy genres like fiction or poetry. It's seen as a service genre in the sense that it's a genre used to teach 19-year-olds how to write in first-year writing classes. But Carl saw it as something more than that, and so did I, and so did we. And so we began with Montaigne, and just we'd take a decade and go to the library and search for what essayists had said about their form, and began to put that material together and began to have monthly discussions about the form and about these what these writers were saying. And that's really the material that Essayists on the Essay came out of, and that really spurred my interest in the form, because they were great conversations, and we realized there was a lot more there. Formal decisions that were being made that were fully as sophisticated and layered and difficult as those that poets or fiction writers or playwrights make. So we saw that it was more than just the fourth genre.
Well, it's quite obvious that the two books are infused as labors of love. So I like the fact that there was friendship and even a love story behind the generation of them. And I also picked up on the point that you talked about the essay as a service genre. And I think there's a lot of attention, especially in the American essay and the American century, kind of on the class structures that surround the essay. And it's curious enough, for me at least, that you begin, however, not with a kind of class structure that we would associate with service or middle brow culture, but you begin with the genteel class. Your story opens with the genteel essay and gentlemen sitting by firesides.
Well, that's true. And part of the reason for that, I guess, was I had this historical scope or this sweep that the Essayists and the Essay group had given me. So I had, you know, been reading essayists starting with Montaigne, but among American essayists, I had also started with Washington Irving and, Fanny Fern and 19th century essayists. And you can't do that and not encounter Emerson, of course. I mean, he's the 800-pound gorilla, right? And and one of the questions that intrigued me was, why was there not really an Emersonian tradition? I think it was Joel Porte in an article back in the 1970s, I believe, tried to answer what he called the Emerson problem, which is why has this author that we all consider to be one of the greatest American authors, why is he not studied? Why is he not read? Why is he seen as difficult? Why is he seen as crotchety? Or alternately, why is he sometimes reduced to this guy who wrote some bad poetry and offers these kind of aphorisms about self-reliance and American exceptionalism or something? And, if you've read him as an essayist, you know that there's more than that. And yet, why no essayists after that? Why instead were the essayists that dominated in the 50, 60, 70 years after Emerson's death, those essayists that I forget who it was, but someone said, men who parted their names in the middle, Oliver Wendell Holmes and James Russell Lowell and so on. And I also, knowing from the reading that we've been doing that there was going to be an explosion of a new kind of essay, a new group of essayists with the arrival of the columnists in the New York newspapers in the 1920s and the Algonquin Roundtable and all of those people that would lead eventually to E.B. White, to James Baldwin, to a new New Yorker, that I kind of knew where the story was going, when I began to write those pages about the 19th century, and I knew that part of it was, as you suggested, that the middle class changed, their audience changed, and that allowed the essay to change, because the middle class had been in the 19th century these kind of independent entrepreneurs. You know, they were the lawyer or the doctor who hung out a shingle in a small town. They were the preacher in the small town. They were their spouses. They were the school superintendent, the school teacher, and that middle class was changing at the end of the 19th century with the incorporation of America as it's been called, and so those lawyers now came to be on retainer to corporations. They were working for the railroads, or they were working for U.S. Steel. The rise of public education meant that the teachers now were part of a bigger system. They weren't just sort of running their own little independent one-room schoolhouse. They weren't, you know, Laura Ingalls Wilder going out to teach on the prairie. They were part of a system and had to answer to a school board, a school superintendent, and they were then aspiring to teach in colleges, which there was the rise of public higher education, but so on and so forth. And I saw that it was, you know, that America was changing, and that was a lot of why the essay changed. And so I wanted to see why the genteel middle class and the genteel essay had held on for so long. Because I don't think you can call Emerson or Thoreau genteel. I don't think you can call Fanny Fern genteel. but you certainly can call James Russell Lowell or Oliver Wendell Holmes or their lessers, who also had three names, genteel. And it was how did they hold on so long, and then how were they finally undone? Because the essay lagged behind, I think, other genres, poetry and fiction in particular, in arriving at modernism, if it ever really has. And that was a question that I found intriguing.
It's a fascinating engine that fuels the opening of the book. And I think for me, one of the more enlightening moments, and it's kind of one of those things that is, as soon as I read it in the book, I thought, of course, aha, is the way in which you show that the essay as a genre is kind of this spunky phoenix that rises from its own death at the beginning of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And in the progressive era, finds a new way of connecting with an audience and a new way of mattering in these large social changes that you've just been detailing. And that's, of course, what we start to call the column. Mm-hmm. Rather than the essay. And so just that shift in terminology opens up a whole new set of possibilities, or it registers them.
Yeah, yeah. But you're right. I mean, the essay just keeps dying and dying and dying. It's going so fast. It's still going on. You know, my friend Philip Lopate had a terrific piece in the New York Times Book Review, and it must have been mid-1970s, late-1970s, something like that. And it was titled, "The Essay Lives in Disguise," because it keeps coming back as something else, right, as the New Yorker profile or the Nature essay or the New York Times or the New York Review of Books review essay or something like that. And yes, in the 1920s, I think it came back with a vengeance as the column, because here suddenly you had all of these new writers. And it wasn't, as I talk about in the book, there was a kind of an opening act even in Chicago, maybe 20 or 30 years earlier, in what was called the Robin's Egg Revolution by Sherwood Anderson, and that it was a revolution that where the egg fell out of the nest a little too soon, so it never really took off. But it did make possible, and some of those essays even moved to New York. But where it really happened was in New York right after World War I. And I think there were a lot of things that came together to make it happen. I mean, just to tick off a few, and you know, I go into them more in the book. But the war, certainly, for one. I mean, the disillusionment, the kind of the the recognition that America was now a player on the world stage in a way that it hadn't been before, that we'd been called upon on certain sense, or at least we thought we had been called upon to rescue Europe from itself or something. But that this war to end all wars was not going to end all wars, and that it was a horror. So that was one thing, I think, you know, that lost generation feel that was in the air in the 20s. But then the other thing, it was the roaring 20s, and New York was, you know, as Anne Douglas has said in Mongol Manhattan, it was the capital of the modern world. It was where movies were being made, where Broadway was happening, where Gershwin was writing music, where newspapers were 12 daily papers in the city. There were immigrants of all nationalities coming there. The Harlem Renaissance was happening. It was just, you know, this cauldron of cultural activity. And the columnists were basically kind of, they were writing these columns. They had different deadlines, but most of them were writing 5 or 6 days a week. Some of them were also doing play reviews, some book reviews. They were up against tremendous deadlines, but they were selling New York. They were explaining New York to the rest of the country and to the world, but especially the rest of the country, because they were syndicated. So they were being read in papers in Tucson and in Denver and in, you know, California and in Chicago and little towns in Michigan and Atlanta. And so everybody wanted to sort of, you know, what Harold Ross famously referred to as that little old lady in Dubuque. You know, he kind of scorned her and said, "Oh, my magazine will not be for her." But he knew full well that there were a lot of little old ladies in Dubuque out there who wanted to read about New York and wanted to be privy to it a certain way. And that's what the columnists were doing. They were using Yiddish. They were using modernism. They were using the language of the street. They were making allusions to movies and to modern music. And, you know, it was clearly a place that needed a new genre, and that genre was a new reinvigorated essay that they created almost without knowing it, I think.
And I love the little old lady in Dubuque, because this is the moment that you register the essay turns from the genteel reader, who was part and parcel with, you know, the genteel essay and the gentleman writer, to the reading public as imagined and at large. This seems like the perfect moment to maybe turn to your title. And if you'd be willing to give us a gloss on that, because I think, you know, what emerges in this part of the book is that with the columnists in New York City at this moment, that seems for you to be the beginning of what you're calling the American essay.
Right. Well, the story of my title is that it was originally the subtitle. And the title that was the subtitle to was Middle Class / Middle Brow. So I was playing with or trying to look at those questions. And my next book is going to be more thoroughly about middle brow. But that was some of what was being wrestled with at this time as well, because I think 1925 was also – it was the big bang for middle brow culture. And so a lot of these people were a part of that as well. Haywood Broun and Christopher Morley were two of the original judges for the Book of the Month Club, you know, that kind of thing. But I think the editor, Claire Wilcox at the University of Missouri Press, who said that he thought that we needed to get to that while the book was about the middle class and the middle brow, that the book was first and foremost about the essay, and that middle brow and middle class provided the context for that, but that we should focus on that. And I think he was right. And I think it makes the book sound, it focuses what the book is about, and it makes the book sound more substantial, I think, in a certain way. It diffuses what it's about. to have that middle class Mel Brown. So anyway, so he did that, and that subtitle too. I want to footnote here. My good friend Tom Letts, who's the editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books and was a professor of mine at Iowa, he told me way back early on in an early draft of this book that he thought that's what I was writing about. So we'd settled on that title a certain way, or it was there as the subtitle. But then I still need to figure out, well, what is the American essay and what is the American century, which were also vexed problems, I think. You know, so for me, the American essay, kind of like the genteel tradition. The genteel tradition, I think, was over pretty much at the moment that Santa Anna, George Santa Anna, named it in 1911. It's kind of when you're living in it, and when it's the hegemony, or the hegemonic cultural form in which you're existing, it's the air that you're breathing, it's the water you're swimming in. You don't know that you're breathing air. You don't know that you're a fish swimming in water. You can't see it and name and everything. It's only afterwards when you, I don't know, to belabor this metaphor, you're the lungfish that's crawled out on land and you're like, oh, the ocean, you know? And so there were, I think he could identify the genteel culture, the genteel tradition in 1911, kind of pretty much because it was over or was in decline then. And so he could see it in relief. He wasn't living in it. And I think the same thing was true. My view anyway is that the same thing was essentially true of the American century. That once Henry Luce named it in that kind of famous Life magazine editorial that he wrote in 1941, it was 41, 42, 41, I think, that America was not the same kind of dominant nation that he thought it was going to be. It was already, things were starting to turn. And I think because, as Michael Denning has said, because after World War II, which he was writing, you know, Luce is writing on the cusp of World War II, but after World War II, then it's the Cold War. It's not really the American century. It's now the Cold War, or what he calls the age of three worlds, because we also have the dismantling of colonialism, especially in Asia, in the subcontinent, and in Africa, and in the Caribbean. And so you have the rise of whatever you want to call it, the third world, the developing world, whatever. So there are now three kind of poles and everything in that period of from 1950, certainly, I guess, till the present, or at least through to the fall of the wall in 1989, 1990. And so I wanted, okay, well, what made that, when then does the American century start? And I think it started earlier than the 20th century. I think it started more like in the 1870s or 1880s, kind of with the end of Reconstruction, perhaps, and the rise of industrialization in America. And so then I try to think, well, what's the American essay in that period? And that's sort of what we already talked about, I think, what that essay was. But that was the century it was speaking to me. So that century is not really a whole century. It's a short century. And it's a century that was not the 20th century as Luce wanted to identify it, but something shorter. And other people have talked about this as well. Other scholars have said it. The American century ended with the 60s, with Vietnam, with Watergate, you know, wherever. I think it ended earlier.
I think it gives you a very solid period in which to kind of move outward. And I think people are going to be amazed at what goes into the social history of a genre. I mean, you don't only talk about essayists. You don't only talk about contexts like the New Yorker or the Ladies' Home Journal. There are passages in which you're analyzing the change of domestic architecture in order to talk about the nature of the essay. It's a tour de force.
Well, thank you. There were more such passages. I went on a little too long about that. I got fascinated with it. But yeah, where people read, I think, is something that's important to me, because as you alluded to earlier, that gentleman at the fireplace, that kind of retired professor who has a student coming by for Sherry, and they talk about old books or old art at the fireplace, or that gentleman who's looking out from the, you know, the drawing room onto his gardens, and, you know, thinking about the past. That was kind of the person, the persona that typified a certain age, the genteel tradition, and also that kind of essay, I think. Whereas the columnist is somebody entirely different, and he's writing for these people who are living in these new kind of houses and are reading for new reasons and are reading a new configuration. So he's writing for the commuter who's hanging onto a strap on the trolley car going in from those first suburbs, those first trolley car suburbs, like you know, Braintree into Boston, or Quincy into Boston, or you know, Westchester into New York, and that the architecture also, I think, yeah, it was these new middle class, they were living in a new kind of house. They were living in bungalows to large parts. So they were living in houses that now had central heating, that had electric lights and everything. So it was no longer father reading out loud to the family grouped around one fireplace in the parlor after having mother play the piano and they all sang hymns or, you know, kind of pop songs together. And then father read from something that he could feel comfortable reading aloud in the presence of his teenage daughter. You know, that kind of decorum was no longer happening. You had the magazine revolution of the 1890s, and so now you've got Junior upstairs reading his St. Nicholas magazine or his, you know, sporting news or something, and you've got his sister in her room reading maybe Nancy Drew mysteries or, you know, that kind of thing. You have mom reading Ladies' Home Journal in the kitchen maybe, and dad reading you know, who knows what, a golf magazine or a home repair magazine or something like that in the living room, maybe, or the newspaper. And but all of them in all of those magazines reading writers who are writing columns, who are writing something that's akin to the essay. And so domestic architecture, it changed the who was reading what and where. I think, yeah, and what the reading time was like, and they were not by looking at the house where they were reading, by looking at that new bungalow with its different rooms, I was able to individualize that reading public again after having kind of talked about them as being part of this corporate audience that was being targeted by the different magazines and by the different you know, mass publishers that came onto the scene in the 1890s, 1910s, that now I could look at, okay, well, who are they individually? And the house was a way to do that.
And I think that gives you a way to begin to account for the different kinds of essays that emerge and the different voices that emerge within them. I think we have to, of course, turn in a book about the American essay in the American century to who for you becomes the central American essayist, or at least the figure that emerges at the end as one of the heroes of this book, mm-hmm. Which is E.B. White.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and he was, first of all, I think he's a great essayist, a neglected essayist. He's somebody who's, you know, absolutely astounding career as a humorist and a children's book writer. You know, I mean, Charlotte's Web is the most popular children's book ever written. I mean, I forget what it is now. It's something, I think it's sold something like 25 million copies. My own daughter played Fern Arable in a stage production right here. So, you know, it's something that like high school drama departments they're putting on. It's been made into movies and everything. And then, you know, that doesn't even mention Stuart Little and Trump of the Swan. So he's just everybody thinks of him as a children's book writer, or alternately as White of Strunk and White, you know, and they've received that Elements of Style as a high school graduation present or something. And so they don't, you know, people don't know about him in the way that the New Yorker readers of the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s knew him. And I find that criminal because I think he's a great writer. But he also served me well because he had grown up. Yeah, he's born in 1899, so he really grew up. He began reading and writing because he had published in St. Nicholas magazine, for instance, this children's magazine that was written by and for children back in the early part of the 20th century. His family was – his father had been his father's father had been an alcoholic, and so his father had had to go to work when he was 13 years old and work his way up until he became – he was a successful – he was finally the president of a piano manufacturing company. They lived in the first suburb in America, Mount Vernon in New York, and – so it was just this, like, his story was the story I was telling in a certain way, except, you know, on a biographical scale. And it and then he wrote for the New Yorker, which is the quintessential middlebrow magazine. Then, though, he had to break from that. He'd grown up reading and studying and loving those columnist that I was talking about in the 20s, and then kind of essentially became one of them at the New Yorker, but then realized there's got to be something new that he was tired of and having to write with that New Yorker we, you know, that in the little bitty paragraphs at the beginning in the talk of the town and in the notes and comments section where there was no byline. No contributors notes in the New Yorker back then. So nobody knew. I mean, everybody did in New York, but, you know, the little old lady in Dubuque maybe didn't know that this was E.B. White writing this stuff. And he had to use that we, which he said should, it was a corporate voice, was like hiding behind a mask at a masked ball and coming out and kissing all the girls from behind the mask and then going back behind it. He said it was just disreputable. He said it was a form that should be reserved only for the Dionne quintuplets. They should be the only ones to be able to allow that, be allowed to use that we. And he was tired of that. And he was tired of writing just little short humor pieces because he was starting to realize in the last half of the 1930s that he was, well, he already knew he was tremendously privileged, I think, to be doing so well because the New Yorker was doing so well. But he was just in battle with the isolationists, especially Charles and Anne Moreau Lindbergh, but Father Coughlin and all the others that who were saying we need to, you know, just look the other way, that all that stuff that's happening over there in Europe with the rise of fascism, it's on the other side of the pond. We've got this whole ocean between us, you know, let's not get involved. And he felt otherwise, but he could not write about that at the New Yorker. So he leaves the New Yorker, he moves to Maine, and he begins writing not these weekly small pieces that are in first person plural for the New Yorker, but begins to write a signed regular monthly column called One Man's Meat for Harper's Magazine, and begins to really take on the isolationists, begins to really try to figure out what is America about now, what are we fighting for, what do the four freedoms really mean, what is freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. What do they mean? And it was, as he referred to it later, it was an enchanted time. And he ended up collecting those essays in a book called One Man's Meat. And I think it's a neglected masterpiece. And so he served me well. Now, if I had defined the American century as I could easily have done, as going on into the 1950s and the 1960s, then, you know, the book might have ended with James Baldwin or ended with Joan Didion, you know, who I think are perhaps the two great essayists of the next quarter century after White writes One Man's Meat. But I didn't. There may be another book, but yeah, that. So Edie White, he's the hero of the book. He's the hero.
I want you to write that book, actually.
Well, reviewers, that's what they asked for, because I think everybody still thinks of the American century as the 20th century, so they wanted me to go all the way to the end.
Well, I'm sure you could just knock that thing out in the summer or something that. Well, it turns out you do end the book with E.B. White, but you end in contemporary composition classrooms as much as you end with his most famous essay.
I do, because I felt that the essay as that service genre that we talked about, that was where that was tip of that. That's where that's just happening in the worst possible ways, in some ways. And I was working there following on a tremendous essay that Lynn Bloom wrote called The Essay Canon, and where she did this great research where she looked at, I mean, virtually all of the first year writing composition anthologies of the last half of the 20th century. She had research assistants for 2 or 3 years, they're ordering all these, buying them from used bookstores, looking at them and going through all of them, and not just one edition of the Norton Reader, but all 8 editions of the Norton Reader or whatever, and just cataloging, okay, what essays were being taught? How were they being taught? What were the discussion questions like? What were the writing prompts that were being used like? And so on and so forth. And she came to this conclusion, which is that the essay canon, the essays that we know and we teach now, are primarily the essays that are we came to or that are being taught in first-year writing classes. And that part of the problem is, well, there are a couple of problems. One is that's militated toward shorter essays, or in many cases, even excerpts of essays, because you're trying to find pieces that can be taught, can be used by beginning teachers, teaching assistants, graduate students who are teaching for the first time and who need to try to teach whatever this or that rhetorical mode, narrative or description or persuasion or whatever, in a 45-minute class to 19-year-old first-year writing students. So that's part of the problem. Then the other problem is that these anthologies are dehistoricizing the essay because of what they're being asked to do. They're being asked to be used to teach to model a particular writing mode. And I feel that if the essay is to really be seen as a literary genre, if we're going to rethink the essay canon as and see it as not just a pedagogical canon, it can still be a pedagogical canon, but also a literary canon, a national canon, a critical canon, that we need to look at the context. We need to look at the tradition. And certainly there are anthologies that are beginning to do that. I think the three probably most significant ones would be Philip Lopate's The Art of the Personal Essay, certainly, which goes back to the classical world, but comes up to the present when he did it, which was, I think, came out in 1997 or something. And then the Robert Atwan, Bob Atwan, and Joyce Carol Oates anthology, The Best American Essays of the Century, being the 20th century. And then the fine work that John DeGatta has done, both with The Next American Essay, which sort of starts in the 1970s and comes up to whatever, that book came out 2005, I think. And also The Lost Origins of the Essay, his other anthology that tries to do something like what Lopate is doing. And so those anthologies are historical, but they're still anthologies, and there's only so much they can do with the headnotes and so forth, which I understand, having edited Essayists on the Essay with Carl. And so with Carl Klaus. And so I think that we need to look at context as well. We need to look at who were these essays written for, who is reading them, what can that tell us about the essay? So an essay like Once More to the Lake is not seen now as just something that can be knocked out in an hour of class and be used as a to prompt a kind of what I did on my summer vacation essay. Even though it is about this man and his son, E.B. White and his son, Joel, going back to a lake in Maine that E.B. White had gone to when he was a boy, it is that, but it's also about the storm clouds coming in off the North Atlantic and about retreat and about the war to end all wars and about the decline of the middle class or the change in the middle class and so many other things. And then we can begin to look at some of the things that White was doing formally there, I think, in new ways and in richer ways. And you can see the essay through new eyes. And I think that's true for many others. I've got a website, and on my website, my graduate students and I are trying to post we're putting together pages on that website for each of several what we think anyway are significant or important essays, where we try to look at the essay as it first appeared in Partisan Review in 1943 or in Collier's back in 1919 or whatever, and who was reading it then, what did the ads look like, what else was in the table of contents, what was the situation, and then what were the subsequent appearances, and how did it get rethought, and how did it reappear, and how was it changed? How was it edited differently, and so forth? And it's a kind of a teaching tool, but it's also, we hope, a little prompt discussion about what the essay canon is and how it might be reimagined.
I think what you get from the end of your book with Once More to the Lake, which, you know, formally is a beautiful essay, once you plug it back into its history, you also get a new kind of readerly pleasure to just see suddenly the context that was charging that essay that's right off stage, as it were, for White.
I hope so. That's certainly my goal. I'm glad that you see it that way. I think it does. I think you know, when I was in college, I was trained in new criticism and that formalist reading that you look at the text. But then Vietnam happened, and the civil rights movement and the women's movement happened, and we began to occupy buildings, and we began to call for women's studies departments and African-American studies departments. And I began to go to the Radical Caucus, the MLA, and we tried to open up the canon, and I, you know, started reading Marx and became an organizer. And I saw that, you know, context was important, but some of my former teachers who were new critics, some of the best new critics, some of the great new critics, they resisted what we were doing there, and they saw it just as sociology and reductive and so forth. And I never believed that. I always felt that I could take this tool that they had given me, this close reading, and I could use it, but that as a reader, I could return to the text and look at it when my context changed and when what I learned about its context changed, and that I could find a new reading, you know, that kind of what we began to get with the post-structuralists, with Roland Barthes and Foucault and everything, that there's, you know, that there are writerly and readerly texts, as Barthes talks about in SZ, and that there are readings of text. There's not one reading of a text. There's not one text, but there are readings of a text, and so that's what I'm trying to do in that last chapter, where I'm talking about Once More to the Lake. I'm trying to offer a new reading of that great essay.
I think you succeed there. And I think just as you can offer new readings of text, you can offer new readings of the essays. And one of the nice things about your book with Carl Klaus and the collection you've put together there is you begin with ideas about the essay that start with Montaigne in 1580, and you go all the way up to the present, right? The video and radio essay that John Breslin and Jeff Porter write about.
Right.
So I want to make sure we at least get to this question about the essay, since I know that you've continued to write beyond the American century about the essay. In terms of the essay, what's the water we're swimming in now?
is digital water, I guess. I think there's a digital revolution. I don't think we can ignore it. I think that that's – I don't know how that's going to change the essay. I see some ways that I think it's already changing the essay. But you know, there was a great piece what's her name that wrote that great book about Montaigne about 2-3 years ago. But anyway, How to Live. I'm blanking on her name, but anyway, she wrote a great piece. I think it was in the New Republic or somewhere that about if Montaigne were alive now, he'd be a blogger. You know, he'd just keep, because that was what he did. You know, he had three different editions of the essays, and he never took anything out. He only added. You know, and that's sort of what a blog is. It just goes on and on, doesn't it? You know, and it, you write about things that are in the news. You write about yourself. You write about issues that, you know, these blog pieces are occasioned by what's going on in the world, and the essay, like, as columns, as the periodical essays of those London coffee houses at the end of the 18th century, they were, you know, writing pieces that were responding to whatever it was being gossiped about in the on Grub Street or in the coffee house last week. And I think that's what's happening now. And not only that, though, but that you know, it's we're writing differently now. I mean, sure, people are afraid of, like, what's happening to writing because everybody's going to write in 140 character bytes, or it's all Facebook posts or that kind of thing. But there are other possibilities. I mean, what we're doing right now with a podcast, what John Breslin is doing with video essays, and Marilyn Freeman and others, Dante Moore's fabulous piece where he uses Google Maps to write an essay about his relationship with George Plimpton. Embedded video, the book trailers that are now being created to publicize books, or Ron Charles's video book reviews for the Washington Post, or, you know, on and on. I mean, this is, I think this is some of what's happening right now to the essay, and I don't know where it's going, but it's exciting.
Well, I would be curious to know where you're going with your next project, given that, you know, you've got at least one request in to finish off the 20th century. and it sounds like you've got a lot of good thoughts on what's happening right at the moment. Where are you turning next?
Well, I, as I said, I'm putting some work into this online digital archive of essays, and I've been writing some pieces that do update things. I've delivered some papers and conferences and publishing some pieces about James Baldwin and about Joan Didion, and trying to contextualize them in the same way that I did White's Once More to Lake. I did that with Baldwin's Notes of Native Son, and with Didion's The White Album. So I am doing a little of that updating of the book that way. But the book that I'm working on right now, that'll be my next book project, is a book about the progressive trend in middlebrow culture in the United States from 1925 to, and again, I'm not sure where I'm going to end this book, but at least I think into the 1970s or 80s. So it's going to be a book that's going to talk about important moments in middlebrow. I think middlebrow culture has been dismissed as retrograde, as safe, as a dumbing down of high culture, as this kind of faux wannabe culture. And I think it's more complicated than that. And I think that some of the interesting scholars of middlebrow culture have begun to argue as much too. Michael Denning and Joan Shelley Rubin and Janice Radway. And I want to push that a little further. So the book's going to start with the Algonquin Roundtable meeting Sacco and Vanzetti, essentially. But there was this moment in the 1927 where Sacco and Vanzetti, the two Italian immigrant anarchists who were they may have been guilty, they may not, but they certainly didn't get a fair trial. And they were being executed, and Dorothy Parker and Haywood Bruin especially, but some of the other Algonquin Roundtable people got involved in that movement to try to save them. And it was it was a moment where they kind of realized, I think, you know, this is 2 years before the crash. This is 2 years before the 1930s really began. And we had that kind of descent into the Depression and the, you know, rise of communism in the United States, the Communist Party in the, among intellectuals in the United States anyway. And yet they're already realizing we've got to be more serious. And we, in a certain sense, we have been fiddling as Rome burns. So anyway, that's where it starts. And then it's going to touch on certain, what I see in key, as being kind of key moments or in middlebrow culture, like Marian Anderson singing on the Lincoln Memorial in a concert that was organized by Eleanor Roosevelt for her, because Marian Anderson, the great African-American opera singer, was not allowed to sing in the in the auditorium that was managed by the Daughters of the American Revolution in Washington, D.C. Harry Belafonte on the Ed Sullivan Show, these kinds of moments. And I want to try my model for this book is a book called A Chance Meeting by Rachel Cohen, where she wrote in, I think it's about 30, 33 small chapters. Each chapter may be about 10, 12 pages long, not encumbered by a lot of footnotes. Each chapter containing at least one or sometimes two photographs. And it's and each chapter focusing, in her case anyway, on a meeting between two or among three or four artists that you wouldn't necessarily – sometimes you see them as being – you knew that they knew each other, but other times you're surprised that they knew each other. Charlie Chaplin and W.E.B. Du Bois running into each other outside of a movie theater in Switzerland, you know, something like that. But also other configurations, constellations of people that you do know are important for culture, the development of American, in her case, modernist culture. Her book begins with Henry James Jr. and Sr. going to get their picture taken by Matthew Brady in, I think, 1855 or something. And it ends with Robert Lowell and Norman Mailer on the steps of the Pentagon in that great protest against the war in 1967. So that's my goal, is to come up with, I don't know if it'll be 30 chapters, but small chapters like that that show a progression and show people coming and going and helping each other and developing a strain of middle-class, middle-brow culture that was more progressive and more interesting and, I think, kind of more important than middle-brow culture has traditionally been seen as being. So that's what's next.
It sounds fascinating. I hope once you finish it, you'll come back and... Well, Ned Stuckey French, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Eric. I was honored to be asked, and I look forward to looking at more of these podcasts. They sound like a great project.
I'm Eric LeMay, and this is the New Books Network. You've been listening to Ned Stuckey French, author of The American Essay in the American Century, and co-editor with Carl Klaus of Essayists on the Essay.